Welcome to the Proper Mental Podcast. Normalizing open and honest conversations about mental health by having open and honest conversations about mental health. Welcome to episode 12 of the Proper Mental Podcast, and my guest this week is Dr. Emilia Thompson. Emilia is a registered nutritionist with the Association for Nutrition. She's a lecturer and educator in sports nutrition and a qualified life coach. She's got a BSc degree in sports biomedicine and an MSc in sports and exercise nutrition and a PhD in exercise physiology. So to say that Emilia knows what she's talking about is an understatement. And I followed her on social media for a while, and I was really, really keen to get her on as a guest for a lot of reasons. Obviously, she's a nutritionist, but we talk about so much more than food. And if you follow Emilia on social media, if you don't, I suggest that you do, because she's fantastic. But she talks, her approach is just, it's so deep, it's so layered, it's multifaceted. She looks at, of course she looks at food, but she also looks at physical health, mental health, emotional health, spiritual health, really kind of this really holistic layered approach. And yeah, she puts it in the context of food and nutrition, but a lot of what she's talking about you can apply to all aspects of mental health, and it's really going to help. And we talk about how important it is to have a good relationship with yourself and how to talk to yourself and align in with your values and all that sort of stuff. We talk about journaling and meditation. We talk about social media. You know, this stuff is so, so, so important and so relevant to the mental health conversation. And she was just a fantastic guest. She's a very, very impressive woman. And I think that the most impressive thing, or one of the most impressive things about her for me, was how much knowledge she had at her fingertips. So I'd ask her some quite big or even vague questions, and she just had everything there. She just had all the, you know, the techniques, all the stats, all the studies, all the science to back up everything she was saying, all the tips and techniques, and she could just talk it all through and break it down in a really, really understandable way. So yeah, there's so much. This is a big episode. There's a lot of stuff to take in. I definitely recommend having a notebook with you for this one, because yeah, she drops some absolute bombs. It's really, really good. And yeah, I can't wait for you to hear it. If you'd like to connect with Emilia on social media, she is on at Emilia Thompson, PhD, or for the educational side of what she does, her nutrition courses and stuff like that, it's EIQ underscore nutrition, and her website is www.emilia.fitness. If you want to connect with me via the podcast, at Proper Mental Podcast and all the usual platforms, and if you'd like to do me a solid and throw a review up on iTunes and subscribe while you're there, it'd be very much appreciated. This is another Monday episode, and our next one, episode 13, will be with you on Thursday. So through the month of May, we're carrying on, dropping two a week. So yeah, keep your eyes peeled for that. And also next week, we're going to be announcing a bit of a fundraiser, a bit of a giveaway. We've been tapping some of our previous guests up for different merch and bits and bobs, and we're going to put it all together in a big package and raffle it off to raise some money. And 100% of the profits are going to be going to a mental health support charity. And I think maybe next week or the week after, we're going to announce some merch as well. Again, the merch is coming out. It's completely non-profit. It's just about raising a few quid for people that are doing amazing things. So keep your eyes peeled for that. That's everything I need to tell you about. So here we are with episode 12, Dr. Emilia Thompson. Thanks for listening. Enjoy. For it. Right, cool. So welcome to another episode of the Proper Mental Podcast, and today I am joined by Dr. Emilia Thompson. Hi Emilia, how are you?
Hi, I'm well, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. Good, good, good. How's life at the moment, mate? How's the lockdowns and all this sort of stuff treating you?
Oh, it's just delightful, like everyone else, right? It's just
Yeah.
dream come true. It's fine, I'm, I think like most people now, I'm seeing the light at the end of the tunnel. And I don't know, I think we've been in it for a year now. I'm kind of in a routine with it. So yeah, I actually can't complain. I feel really lucky to be working and to be safe in a house and have a bubble, and I'm kind of on that wavelength at the moment. But I think, I don't know if you're the same, but you go through phases with lockdown where you feel grateful and at peace, and then the next week you feel frustrated and sad, and then you kind of just go in this circle. So this week is a great week.
Yeah, well, that's good. We'll take 1 week at a 1 week at a time. Yeah, I'm exactly the same. Good days and bad days. And I've been spending ages feeling like, oh, I can't wait for the world to get back to normal. I want to do this and want to do that. And then as soon as there's a date on the calendar, I'm sort of, well, I don't really know if I want to quite go back to normal yet.
Yeah, me too. I saw something the other day that was like, how good does it feel to make plans? And I thought, am I supposed to have made plans? Apparently, this is the thing. So, yeah.
That's it, man. Out of practice.
Yeah.
So if we could just start, would you be able to tell us just a little bit about you and about what you do really specifically?
Yeah, so I'm a nutrition consultant and online educator in nutrition, and I work predominantly with people who are looking to improve their relationships with food in some way. I'm also a trainee counsellor, so I implement some of that stuff within my coaching. So I take a very holistic, compassionate based approach to coaching. It's very person-centered. So although my background is nutrition and science, actually the way that I coach is very holistic, and almost therapy-led. But obviously within my scope at the moment as a nutrition consultant predominantly. And so I head up a couple of a team with a couple of coaches who work in the same way and teach EIQ nutrition, which is a holistic evidence-based approach to nutrition. So it incorporates a lot of the nutrition fundamentals, but it also incorporates things like mindfulness and compassion and psychological flexibility and all of the good stuff as well, and how that impacts nutritional choices and health, like healthy lifestyle.
Yeah, sure. Oh, that's awesome, because that's kind of partly why I asked you to introduce yourself, really, because I just talking of you as a nutritionist doesn't really do justice to the approach that you take. And it also really explains like why we approached you to get you on, because we're obviously a mental health podcast. And we want to talk about all different aspects of mental health, mental illness. It'd be very easy for us to just to have like, because we're two white blokes in our mid to late 30s, to have on a load of other white blokes in the mid to late 30s and talk about depression, right? So we want to kind of like explore some other stuff. And I think when it comes to food and whether that's eating disorders, whether that's, emotional attachments or all these different things that can happen with food, it can often get forgotten about in the mental health conversation because there's a very physical outcome. But your relationship with your diet is more in your head than your belly, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And if we're looking at things like, for example, binge eating disorder, which is a kind of underdiagnosed eating disorder, it's not as commonly known as things like anorexia nervosa, etc. We know that one of the main correlates with binge eating disorder is depression. So when we're looking into the eating disorder realm, there's a lot of intertwining between mental health. It is a mental health issue. And so they're very, very closely related. But then even if we're looking at the subclinical side of things, so more the area that I work in terms of people who overeat, emotionally eat, find control with their food, but don't necessarily hit the threshold of people with eating disorders, most of this is to do with the way that they think about food, whether that be because they eat in response to certain emotions or because they have potentially unmet needs from when they grew up, or because they don't want to feel emotion, so they eat in that sense. So, like I said, I started from a nutritionist scientist background, but the more I started to work with people, the more I realized actually for a lot of people who get into this and think that they need a diet plan, a lot of them need therapy more so than they need a diet plan. And I try and fill that middle ground, so to speak, if people don't feel that they want to go down therapy route or the diet plans don't work for them, because ultimately they know they have the knowledge, but they don't have the ability. They have the ability, but they don't know how to use that ability to actually eat according to their health goals, whatever those goals may be.
Yeah, sure. Because it is like modern life in a lot of different aspects of mental health. It kind of takes us so far away from you know, from our natural design or from ourselves, it's easy to lose track, isn't it? And get attached to different things. So what sort of people do you work with in general? You know, is it general population? Are you heavily involved in sports? What's kind of what's your
predominantly I work with people in the general population, but I think my kind of the most of my clients tend to be people who have come from chronic dieting backgrounds, so they've dieted on and off for a long time, or I get people who have been athletes, or a lot of people who have been heavily involved in fitness, so the aesthetic side of things, who have developed or exacerbated negative relationships with food as a result of chronic dieting and chronic use of meal plans and very much focus on the external side of things. And usually get the people who are just done with that, and they have tried every kind of structure that they can find in terms of helping them stick to a diet, but they for whatever reason they just keep kind of either self-sabotaging or falling back into the way that they were before, and they're fed up of that. So I came from a bodybuilding background, and so initially when I started doing this, I worked with a lot of people who'd come out of bodybuilding, which is very extreme, and we see a lot of disordered relationships with food within bodybuilding. And so I kind of became the person who people went to once they'd finished bodybuilding and they needed to try and restore their relationship with food in some way, but who still understood that they have physique goals. And you know, so I kind of filled that space, and then but now it's kind of opened up to people, you know, bodybuilders are not particularly different from anyone else that's chronically dieted, maybe a little bit more extreme, but probably not in a lot of cases.
Yeah, sure. Bodybuilding's fascinating, you know, it's such a an unusual space, and I can really get some aspects of it, you know, the dedication, the control, you know, it's incredibly hard work, but it's also you know, I mean, you're literally changing the way you look to stand in your pants in front of strangers and asking them to judge you, right? Like, that's really intense, really, yeah, really intense.
Absolutely. And it's not even, you know, when you say it like that, it sounds so obscene. And it's, I think a lot of the time, it's not about the actual day. It's about the control that it gives people for the however many months leading up to it, if not years for some people, that leads up to that one day. It's about the, for a lot of people, it can improve their self-efficacy because they have these boxes to tick and they feel like they're accomplishing something. And bodybuilding happens to be the outlet that they use that for. But at the same time, bodybuilding and these types of sports, they attract certain people who have similar characteristics, say, for example, to those who develop eating disorders, perfectionists, narcissistic tendencies. These types of attributes are similar in both populations. And so it attracts these types of people. And then you add on top of this all of this consistent self-critique and self-reflection and all of the impacts that come with dieting in a normal population. On steroids, with that's ironic, but like, you know, the extreme version of that, within getting to really, really lean, and you just have this complete hurricane of attributes that can be really detrimental. But you know, when you hear people say it helps improve their confidence and things, it does to some degree, because they feel like they're accomplishing something, you know. But ultimately, when we look at things, same with dieting, really, if you take anything to the extreme, it negatively impacts your body image, it negatively impacts your self-esteem. But a lot of the time, we don't like to admit that whilst we're in the process of it. And that's what you get. And I mean, that certainly was me when I was bodybuilding, and you see a lot with other bodybuilders. When you're in it, it's you can kind of feel like you're in some sort of control because you're following a plan. And then when you come out of it and you don't have that plan, it can be quite challenging.
Yeah, sure. I suppose when everything's like as well focused on getting to a certain point, you know, we hear a lot of in all different things, whether it's sport, in life, or you know, you focus a lot of attention on getting to a certain place, and then when you kind of get there, it's a little bit like, oh, what now, you know, what, yeah. how do we carry on? Yeah, so like, this is going to be a really big question, and I was trying to think of a way of breaking it down into a smaller one, but I couldn't, so I'm just going to go for it and see what comes up. But why is food so complicated? Because it's a basic human need, right? And we don't, I was thinking about this before, and the vast majority of people I know have some sort of thing over food. It might be a big thing, it might be a small thing, it might, you know, but we're not as concerned about like the quality of water we drink or the air that we breathe, but food seems to be a real thing. Do you think that's societal? Do you think it's, you know, is it a self-medicating thing? Like, how, what, You know, I know that's a tricky question to answer, but
you know what? It's not even that it's tricky. It's just so loaded. There are so many ways that you could go down with this, from the basic physiological level of food has specific physiological responses in our brain, for example, dopamine responses that trigger certain changes in our mood state. So that's the kind of, you know, there are lots of chemical reactions, I always say, that go on when you consume food that impact your mood around food. So that's the baseline. But then you've got things like, the way that you grow up. Let's think of a child who is around an environment where there's food scarcity, so they don't often feel satiated, they don't often get as much food as they require or they need. As they then develop and grow older, they often will feel that they may well fall into things like binge eating or overeating, because it's kind of to counteract what they experience as a child. That's, you know, one example. You could have a child who grew up around a parent with disordered eating habits, and so they kind of interject these values of their parents that say this is a good food, this is a bad food. And so as we grow older, we then develop these food rules around what we should and shouldn't eat, and then that causes us to have disordered eating habits. A lot of the time we use food to meet our either emotional needs or our unmet needs. So if we think of unmet needs first of all, so have you heard of Maslow's hierarchy of needs before?
I have indeed, yes.
Yeah, so you've probably talked about it a lot, but if we think about Maslow's hierarchy of needs, this kind of basically describes that we need to reach these certain levels of we need to achieve certain things in life to feel safe and to ultimately achieve what we call the term self-actualization. So you kind of work up this pyramid and hierarchy of needs, and at the base level there's things like food, water, sleep. But as we move up, we have things like love, belonging, connection. And so when we don't fulfill these needs, we often don't recognize that we're not fulfilling these needs, and we try to meet that need somewhere else, and often that comes down to food. And that could be a learned behavior. So for example, if you were a child who, say you didn't feel connected to your parents, or you were bullied at school and you didn't have that connection with socially, you may have turned to food to provide that level of comfort, or what felt like comfort at the time. So that as you get older and you still feel that you lack that need is still not met, you still consistently turn to food. And that can be a really tricky one to decipher, because often it's not a feeling that you're aware of. It's kind of underlying. You know, you could be happy day to day, but actually deep down you're missing this one thing that is like allows you to feel whole. But without recognizing it, you turn to food often and you just think, why am I consistently overeating? There's nothing triggering me in the moment.
Yeah, sure.
And so, you know, again, that's a learned behavior from when you're a child, and a lot of it is to do with how we have developed these coping strategies when we were younger, and they kind of translate into as we're older. But at the same time, you've got these unmet needs. That was just kind of one example, but then you've also got feelings in the moment. So stress eating, boredom eating, you know, we all know that, like the kind of classic Bridget Jones, when you're upset you take a tub of Ben and Jerry's, which is completely fine. You know, coping with food is a coping mechanism, is absolutely fine, and it's natural and it's normal, and it can genuinely provide some level of comfort. The issue is when it's your only coping mechanism and you don't have anything else to turn to, and it's consistently happening, and you feel guilty for it and you feel shame about it. And obviously shame is really detrimental to our behaviours and our mood states. And so if we continuously meet our feelings in the moment with food, we might be doing this to, for example, avoid the feeling. We don't want to recognize that we're heartbroken. We might be trying to suppress our feelings. Or again, it might be a learned behavior. And so there's so many complexities to it. And then if we take the more social side of things, you've got things like, I talk about the patriarchy a lot, right? And for lots of reasons, but it seems to fall into a lot of the conversations I have at the moment, because if you think about someone, so I'm a woman in my 30s, I grew up around role models. You know, I had a whole row of Kate Moss on my wall, who was famous for saying nothing tastes as good as skinny feels. Like, it's obscene. And of course, nowadays, cancel culture would be like, I'll see you later. You're not.
Yeah, yeah.
But in the 90s and early 2000s, that's what we were exposed to. we consistently are exposed, and we still are, to be fair, to body comparisons, to being told how to get thinner. It was an assumption that we should always want to be smaller, and that a lot of that has to do with patriarchal conditioning, that women should want to always be smaller and conform and be nice and all of these things. And so again, we can fall into that side of things, and that falls into diet culture, where we think we have to consistently diet. And dieting itself can be detrimental to our relationships with food. It can increase our risk of things like binge eating and overeating and disordered eating. Not always. So you've just got this complete like tornado, like I said, of just all of these different factors coming in, and it can be really, really difficult to unpick which are your values and what you want to do and what's right for you versus all of these interjected values and what we call conditions of worth, where, you know, I'm only worthy within the society if I am small and skinny and lean. It's about stripping all of those things back and figuring out actually where do I feel happiest and healthiest. And a lot of the time it's not when you're at your leanest. It's probably not when you're at your leanest at all, actually. It's probably somewhere in between where you feel like you're your healthiest and happiest self. So it's difficult to unpick, and everyone is influenced by different things, but it's very complex.
Yeah, certainly. And I suppose we've got all this underlying emotional stuff going on. And then as well as that, we're being like bombarded by advertising and people not being particularly straight up with what means what and trying to sell us stuff. And it just stirs the pot, right? And just sort of complicates things more and stuff like that.
Yeah.
It's really interesting you mentioned values there, because that was something I wanted to talk to you about as well. It's something you mentioned a lot on your social media. And the more we do this podcast, we speak to loads of different people from loads of different backgrounds and communities and all this different, you know, different people completely. And certain things keep coming up time and time again. And it doesn't matter where you're from or what you do, these things come up. And one of them regarding to values is when people spend a long time living in a life that's not aligned with their values, eventually it reaches some sort of breaking point and something, you know, something happens. So do you spend a lot of time with clients when they first sign up with you, getting them to establish their values and, you know, that sort of thing?
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me that that comes up a lot. It's interesting to hear, but it doesn't surprise me at all. There's this kind of concept within the kind of person-centered therapy approach where we say if you feel insecure or incongruent or anxious about something, often it's because your true self is not aligned with how you're acting, and there's that incongruence there. And so you see it a lot with nutrition, a lot with people's relationships with food. And so yeah, I work with clients a lot on this, especially initially, but we will review it consistently. You know, some of my clients work with me for years, and so of course their values change. I see, for example, when people get pregnant, this really is an important point here, because body image and food relationships change a lot when people fall pregnant. But it's so important, because I think fat loss as a goal is almost like the kind of an umbrella term for so many other different things that people are trying to achieve, but people often struggle to communicate that. They think they want fat loss, but actually once you look a little bit below the surface, it's like, say you've got someone who's a healthy body weight, and body weight's not always a good marker of health, but let's just use that as a broad term.
Oh, yeah.
If you've got somebody who's a healthy body weight and they say they want fat loss, well, why do you want fat loss? Oh, because I feel like I'll be happier when I've got fat loss. That's probably not the case. It's probably that something else in your life is not making you happy right now. Or it could be often that you're looking for acceptance, and you think that if you drop body fat, you will be accepted into either the fitness community or within your friends, or, you know, in a certain situation, you feel like if you're in a different body, you'll feel accepted. Maybe it's, for example, I work with a lot of people who are personal trainers, and they think that they will be accepted in their job if they look a certain way. And so actually when you unpick this, what they think is a goal of fat loss, into their actual what's important to them right now, and I think framing it in that way of saying what is important to you right now is really helpful, rather than saying what do you value, because I think that can be confusing for some people. And you say, well, what is important to you? And they just say, well, I actually just want to be healthy and happy. Okay, well, this is fat loss is not the way to go here. Let's work on X, Y, and Z instead. And I think within nutrition and fitness, the values are so important, and actually they've become a bit of a buzzword in the last 6 months, and it's interesting to see the conversation around it. People talk about values and they say, well, you value aesthetics, or you value money, and it's so surface level, but you really need to look at like, what is it that's missing from your life? What are you trying to achieve that you're not quite on it yet with? And you think that food is going to solve this. You know, I had a client this morning, she'd listened to one of my earlier podcasts that I was talking about the morality of dieting. And I was talking about this, actually, the values and saying, you know, a lot of people will diet for these reasons. She said, and she texted me yesterday and said, you know, I just cried all the way through that podcast because all of these values that you said that might be hidden under fat loss are all the values that I've been trying to achieve for the last 5 years, and I've never been able to stick to my diet. And now I realize that none of that was ever going to get me what I need. And I think for a lot of people that can be a really, really great realization, because once you let go of the idea that it's going to change when you change your body, you can then start to achieve these things. And actually, you know, we have a finite amount of energy in our day and our lives, and we can only spend so much time on food and diet and exercise. And a lot of the time people spend so much of their energy trying to achieve something through changing their body that they spend less energy on, for example, going on dates or establishing good friendships or socializing. And actually all they're looking for is connection, and they think they're going to get this through changing their body, but what they're actually doing is taking all of the energy away from doing these other things and focusing it onto their body. And we actually want to flip that on its head and use nutrition to support these things. And that's how you achieve your goals and work in line with your values and get to that kind of place of contentment. But it takes a lot of self-awareness, and that's really hard when you're surrounded by the media, like you said, and social media and all of these mixed messages and misinformation. It's really hard to come back to yourself and figure that out for yourself. And you have to keep having these honest conversations over and over and over again until it kind of clicks.
Yeah, sure. Like, you know, the work never stops, right? It's a constant process. Yeah. So like, it is something people found very, very hard to do. And yeah, if you say to someone, you know, oh, what sort of things do you value? We tend to, yeah, like you say, we go surface based, right? It's like, oh, I want to drive a nice car and, you know, all this sort of stuff. And people don't always understand that question. And we're getting further away from, you know, from ourselves in modern society, right? So how do you start to get someone to connect to that? I know there's another big question, but I, you know, I've seen in your social as well, you mentioned stuff like, you know, journaling and gratitude practices and all these sorts of things. And one thing I've really noticed about a lot of the stuff you talk about on your socials, you apply it amazingly to nutrition, but you could also apply that to so many aspects of health, whether that's like mental health, physical health, spiritual, emotional, it ticks so many boxes, you know, which is another reason I'd like to get into it. But yeah, so how does someone start connecting to have a think about what they value in life?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And I also think, just to reiterate what you've said in terms of all of these, health is multifaceted. And so when I come at nutrition, I am trying to think of it as a holistic thing. But like what you're saying, spiritual health, so important that it's kind of forgotten about, especially in the fitness industry. We focus on fat loss. We don't focus on all these other health markers. And I think that's actually one way that you get people to think about it, is to say, well, these are all your other aspects of health. How are you working on these as well? And it just immediately makes people start to think about the kind of, well, different approaches. So yeah, I use a lot of different techniques with clients. Meditation, I think, for a lot of people, not everyone, but for a lot of people, meditation can be really helpful, because one of the core facets of meditation is mindfulness. And so becoming more mindful of your thoughts and your thought patterns, as well as actually when it comes to eating, mindful of the way that you treat your body, all of these things. Mindfulness is so important to start beginning that self-awareness journey. And so for some people, meditation is not helpful. If you've got a lot of trauma in your back, for example, it can be quite triggering. So, you know, I'm not blanket recommending it, but meditation is great. Journaling is great. You know, sometimes I'll have clients journal every day, and we do it in a kind of structured way. So for example, when you first wake up, when you're semi-conscious, taking 20 minutes just to write down whatever you're thinking in your head, that can be helpful. For other people, it can be journaling around specific times, whether that be overeating or just general feelings of anxiety or triggers. Journaling then can be really important. And kind of structuring that in a way that says that are open with questions. So things like, I'm feeling this way, this is why I feel this way, this was the trigger, the stories that I'm telling myself about this situation are, is this thought or is this fact? These types of questions can be so helpful when you're journaling, because you start to recognize the narratives that you have in your head. So an example of someone who's dieting for, they could have a core belief that they're not enough. This is really common. If you have a core belief that you're not enough, you might think that you often have a perfectionist mindset. So you think, if I can be perfect at all of these things, I will feel enough, I'll feel good enough. And we see this a lot with dieting, right? Dieting allows you the situation to count and track and exercise and log and be 100%. But often what happens there is if we think, quote unquote, fall off, we end up in a kind of screw it mentality and we fall into the cycle over and over again. But if you've got an example, say you have this belief of I'm not enough, and you're actually using journaling in this situation, I'm trying to think of a life example here. Say you got criticized at work, or you got some bad feedback at work, and so you're journaling it and you say, this is what happened. And then you say, the stories that I'm telling myself about the fact that my boss said she didn't like that presentation, rather than saying, it's not me she doesn't like, it's the presentation that she just couldn't relate to, you say, the story that I'm telling myself is actually that I'm not good at my job, I'm crap at my job, I'm not good enough. And it ties into your core belief. And you can say, well, is that a truth? Or is that a thought that I'm having? And you can say, well, actually, that's probably not the truth. I'm good at my job. All of these other pieces of evidence that I have attest to the fact that I'm good at my job. I've had good feedback 95% of the time. And so you can start to work through it and you can say, well, that thought's actually not helpful. How can I reframe this thought? And it might be, my boss didn't understand that bit of work. Now I know how to make that work better. Which is a lot more conducive to behavior change and a helpful attitude than saying, I'm a crap person and I just knew that I wasn't good enough. I may as well just not bother.
Yeah.
And that's just kind of one tiny little example, I suppose, but journaling can be so effective for that.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, very much. So we tend to everything we think we take for granted that because we've thought it, it's gospel. And sometimes you can make really big decisions based on thoughts that just simply aren't true, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think the realization that you are not your thoughts is such a simple thing, and it's a classic Instagram meme, right? You are not your thoughts. But once you realize what that actually means and you really recognize that you are the awareness and actually that those thoughts are running around in your head, and you can take a step back and you can say, I'm not those thoughts. I have the ability to say I'm not going to entertain those thoughts. It's hugely powerful. And it's a work in progress. You know, I still call myself out on it when I'm running away with stories in my head. And I have to say, well, like, I'm entertaining that. I'm going to be quiet now because that's not good enough. But it can be transformative. The other thing as well, like self-compassion is associated. When we're looking at nutrition and body image, self-compassion is associated with improved relationships with food, reduced disordered eating, reduced emotional eating. It's associated with improved diet success. It's improved body image. Self-compassion is incredible, and so that's something again that I work with clients on. You know, little things like how you talk to yourself, speaking to yourself kindly, would you say this to your best friend, these kind of really basic techniques, all the way up to some of my clients will write themselves like letters, loving letters to themselves.
Yeah,
that can be really, really helpful. And when I run a workshop or something, I usually put that into the workshop, and it makes people really realize just how horrifically they talk to themselves. And you know, if you talk to yourself like crap, you treat yourself like crap because you think that you are crap. But we are brought up in the society to always be more, which means we are brought up in the society to never be enough. And so we constantly tell ourselves we're not enough. And we treat ourselves that way. And so self-compassion is hugely important. And even when we're looking at things like body image, when you look in the mirror, do you look at the things you don't like about yourself and say, this needs to get better? Or do you look at yourself in the eyes and say, you're a pretty decent human and you did some really cool, kind things today? And it sounds airy-fairy, but it's the evidence is there to support it. And it's so powerful. But people often don't want to put the work into that stuff because it's not quantitative. They can't tick the box. They can't say, oh, well, I feel 0.1% better about myself today because my watch tells me that. It's not tangible, so it's harder. It's harder to do.
Yeah. You just have to trust the process, right? You know, yeah. It's like eating vegetables. I've never been walking down the street and gone, oh, do you know what? I feel amazing from eating all these vegetables. I just like eat them and hope that they're doing what they're supposed to do, right?
Absolutely that.
So how did you get into this approach? Because it's not there's a lot going on here, right? This isn't you can't play around with this stuff. So how did you start to dip your toe into these waters and take that to another level?
Like I say, my background is very academic, but I always had a bit of a dodgy relationship with food myself. I had quite disordered eating habits growing up, and I used food very much like what I was talking about earlier. Food was my way of suppressing because of things that happened when I was a teenager within my family, and so I always suppressed my feelings with food. And my sister had an eating disorder, which is, she's open about that, and so I kind of grew up around disordered eating habits, and I became like, I loved food and I started studying nutrition. So I got all of my academic background, and then when I was probably in my 20s, I had a really emotionally abusive relationship, and at the time I was in Loughborough studying within the sports department, and a lot of my friends were male, and they said, come on, like, we're going to go to the gym and you're going to get strong, and that's going to, that will probably really help you, because at this point I ran a lot, I didn't really eat, and I was insecure. And so I started weight training and fell into bodybuilding at that time, you know, over the next couple of years, because I found it helped my confidence to some degree, and I got stronger. But what happened at the back of that is I came through competing and I fell into the trap that most competitors will fall into, of this exacerbated sort of eating cycle at the end of it, where at the end of the show, once you'd finished that season, you often fall into an over-restrict binge cycle. It's quite common. And so there was no transparency in the industry at the time. There was nobody told me that that might happen. And so I kind of, because I had my researcher head on, I was lecturing at the time, I just kind of delved into the research around what do people do when they're binge eating, what's the actual science here. And I fell into mindfulness and mindful eating, and that was kind of the start of it. Then I started meditating and kind of went on my own spiritual journey, so to speak, at the same time as looking at the research. And I started communicating that to people, like online. I was really transparent about myself and about what I was finding out, and it basically just escalated and snowballed from there. I found that naturally for me, my business progressed that way because there was a niche there that nobody was speaking about. And personally, the more I did of it, the more kind of I learned about self-compassion and things, the more my life felt fulfilled. And it just kind of, even now, the more I'm learning, I still actively will add things into my clients' programming every week, then I find new things out. And so, yeah, I started studying after my PhD stuff. I started studying in self-compassion. My brother lives in California. And so over there, they have the UCLA Mindfulness Awareness Research Center. Wow. So I went there a few times and did some of their courses and really just learned the evidence was there. Because when I first started, I remember everyone thought I was really airy-fairy. And because I had a PhD, I kind of got away with it to some degree. But I know that I've had feedback. People thought I was really airy-fairy. So it was nice to go somewhere that they said, this is the evidence behind writing a compassionate letter to yourself. And I was like, oh, goodness, this is where I need to be. and then I loved it. And that's so aligned with everything that I believe. And like we were saying, you know, when you really value, like I value connection, I value love, and I can put those things into my work with these types of methods. And so it kind of fits really nicely for me.
Yeah, that's awesome. I think so much of the spiritual, and I'm not a huge fan of the term spiritual, but there isn't another one, so we all have to use it, right?
Exactly.
But there's so much science behind it now, and in things like yoga and stuff, they might use different words, but if you look at what's physically happening in the body physiologically, then it's just there, it's happening. Yeah. You know, it's science. Yeah. So you're working with these deep things, and you know, we're sort of learning that, you know, food might be the thing, but behind the thing there's probably another thing, right? So you have to hold a lot of space for other people. So how do you protect yourself if you're holding space for other people?
Yeah, that's a great question, especially for me right now for various reasons. I have really strong boundaries. Really strong boundaries is something I learned after a long time doing my PhD and going through hell and never having any boundaries at all. I have very strong boundaries. I limit my workload. Although I'm self-employed and I run a business, I'm still very strict with how much of that I do. You know, I limit myself in terms of how many clients that I work with at any one time. I hire people to work with people because I want to help people, but I just don't physically have the capacity. I make sure I take days off. And I go through therapy myself, and I do all the things that I meet my clients to, or I ask my clients to do myself. And yeah, I think boundaries are the most important thing. And I think that once our boundaries start slipping, that's when we start to struggle with the energy that we have and what we can give to other people. And I just dread to think that I didn't give enough to one of my clients one day. That's like my biggest fear. And I think if I don't set that boundary where I say I'm not going to reply to anyone after 8 p.m., then actually I might give a really crappy response to someone that really needs me, and that's not good enough. And so I think we often think of boundaries as being selfish, but I think it's one of the most selfless things you can do. And also selfish is absolutely fine. I think that's also important to say, like, it's good to be selfish sometimes.
Oh yeah, completely. Yeah, definitely. No, boundaries is huge. And I think people are becoming a little bit more aware of that at the moment. I always say, like, my sort of tagline is that my number one role in life is to protect my own physical, mental, spiritual, emotional health. And when I do that, I'm a better dad, I'm a better coach, I'm a better husband. You know, if I by putting those things first, then it knocks on, you know. One thing that really comes across as well with your work is you're incredibly authentic. Like, you can tell. I, as someone who's and I'm going to use another really wanky expression, but for someone who's done a lot of the work, I think you can spot other people who've done a lot of the work, right? By the terminology and the way people talk and stuff like that. And you're very, very authentic. You clearly practice what you preach. You clearly live it. Thanks. How do you maintain that authenticity? Because you've got a very big presence on social media, and it's hard, even though we all know, like, I know that likes and follows are a vanity metric, and still I'll put some content out that doesn't connect and I'll be like, oh fuck, you know, like, even though I know it doesn't matter. Yeah. So how in this space and in the fitness industry, it's so hard to be authentic in the fitness industry. So how do you keep true to you? How do you keep yourself on that path?
Oh, that's a good question. I also do that, by the way. If I put something out and it doesn't connect, I'm like, oh, so don't worry about that.
I tell everyone else, oh, it doesn't matter. And then if something doesn't well, I say to my wife, I say, I spent an hour on that and no one's bloody read it.
Yeah, me too. Me too. My best friend does that for me. And she's like, you know, this doesn't matter, but I know that must be frustrating. Instagram algorithms. I'm like, I know, especially as a female, if you put anything about sexism or misogyny, Instagram hates it and it bumps you right back down. And it's so
really, yeah.
Do you know what? That's a good question. Do you know what? I think that you feel yourself if you're not being authentic, right? You feel something doesn't sit right with you. An example of this for me recently has been the after International Women's Day, the Meghan and Harry interview, the horrendous story of Sarah Everard. That week for me was really heavy, and I'm an outspoken feminist. I am a quote unquote feminist killjoy, and so I found that week really, really tough. And I was trying to share some helpful stuff within the fitness space, because the fitness space was very quiet at that time, about what we can do as an industry to support equality and feminism. And I just didn't feel right. When I was talking about it, I didn't feel right. And the reason I didn't feel right is because I was being incongruent. I wasn't being authentic, because there were certain aspects of my life within the fitness industry that were, I was encouraging misogyny, and it was various relationships, etc., that I was partaking in, and I felt really inauthentic. And rather than just brushing over it and stopping talking about it, I spoke about it with my friend, probably like you do with your wife, who is my kind of objective sounding board. And she said, you know why you feel that way, don't you? Because you're being incongruent in some way. And so I had to act on it, and I had to say, well, the reason that I feel like this is because I'm entertaining X, Y, and Z, which is not conducive to what I'm talking about on social media. What's my authentic self? And my authentic self is that I believe in fighting against the patriarchy, but I believe in talking about that, so I have to take these actions. And I think really listening to the thoughts that you're having about when you post things and when you speak about something, if you feel uncomfortable, sometimes uncomfortable is fine, sometimes it's because you're being vulnerable, and that's a good level of uncomfortable, because vulnerability, we like vulnerability, and vulnerability is great for connection. But there's a certain level where if you feel a little bit uncomfortable, and it's not because you've been vulnerable, it's probably because you've said something that you're not true with. And then you have to hold yourself accountable to that and either change the way you say it or change your actions so that you're in line with what you say. And I think it can be really difficult, especially if you're going through something where, you know, you're talking about gratitude and you're talking about contentment, and actually behind the scenes you're grieving or you're going through a really tough time. It can be really, really difficult to try and stay authentic to that. And I just try, those times I try and give myself a bit of grace and accept that ultimately social media is a highlight reel for a lot of things, and we have to be compassionate with ourselves and say, you know, sometimes we have to play the game a little bit and it's not 100% authentic. But I think that what the more authentic you become, the easier it is. And like recently I was on First Dates, the hotel, like the program, and I got some feedback from quite a few people about, said, oh, you were exactly the same as you were when I met you at the expo when you were on TV. And for me, for a program that obviously they edit everything, of course it's a TV program, but for me it was like, okay, I think that's good. It means that even though they've edited it, it's still the same person. And so it is really important to me. I just think you have to hold yourself accountable to any sort of feeling of incongruence that you have and then act on that accordingly. But it's not easy, like you said, the work, so to speak. It's really hard to hold yourself accountable and to do the uncomfortable stuff, but that the uncomfortable stuff is what matters. It's easy to be authentic when you say, I eat pizza for dinner. To me, that's really easy because I eat pizza. Or I don't care, I'm happy to post my body if it's not flattering because I genuinely don't really care about that. But if it's stuff that makes me genuinely uncomfortable, like stopping being friends with someone because they might be sexist and perpetuating what I'm talking about on social media, that's really difficult to do. But you have to do these things, I think, if you want to be authentic and you want to live in line with your values.
Yeah, definitely. And I think because it's an ongoing process. So when you do something difficult, sometimes you get out the other side of it and you go, oh, sorted now, you know, and then you just over time things just slip. And if you don't have that awareness, and that's really cool because that just loops all the way back in round to talking about people's relationship with food, right? So you think you've got it sussed and you've done a bit of journaling and I've meditated a couple of times and I feel really good about myself, but if you don't keep at it, right, then things creep in, don't they? And
absolutely,
those behaviors come back.
Yeah, it's easy to meditate when you feel sad and you force yourself to meditate because you think it's going to help you to feel better. But when you feel good and you're eating well and you're training well and everything's going well, you can kind of let those things slip. And then as soon as something triggers you again, you realize that all of your toolbox strategies that you had in place, you've let them all go, and then you have to start again. So yeah, you have to be aware of those things. It's a constant work in progress. All of it's a constant work in progress, from the baseline of making sure you eat enough protein in the day, all the way up to making sure you're meditating, you know, often and regularly. For me, at least, you have to keep holding yourself accountable to these things.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, yeah, it's taking control, isn't it? You know, if you're having a good day or a good patch of your nutrition or anything like that, then it should be not a surprise. You know, you should have put everything in place to make it a good day. You know, it's not just a case of saying, oh, I'll wake up and see if I have a good day or a bad day. You know, you need to put these things in place to get hold of it, right?
Absolutely. One of the things I do with my clients that's really always really helpful, again, seems very various, intention setting, like in the mornings for their nutrition, for their training, like, you know, what's your intent for the day? And you can even break it down to like, what's your intent with this action? If you're going to go and snack, what's my intent here? Is it to minimize my boredom, or is it because of to satisfy my hunger? And that can be like, intent is so powerful. Your thoughts change your actions, right, and your behaviors. And intent can really help with how you choose your thoughts and therefore how you then act out your behaviors.
Yeah, definitely. So in that kind of way, I suppose you can be your own coach, you know. So like, I'm a huge fan of coaching for like loads of different areas of my life. I have someone that helps me, and a lot of that is because I can talk myself out of anything. I can justify any bad behavior. But when I have to sit and look someone in the eye and say, oh, you know, I didn't go for a run this week because it was raining, and you say it out loud, and you thought, when that was in my head, that sounded a really good excuse, and now I've said it out. But I suppose if you're drilling down into your own behavior and questioning yourself, then yeah, sometimes under scrutiny, some things just don't hold up, right?
Absolutely. And speaking out loud, even if you're speaking to yourself, can be really effective too. Like actually saying to yourself, am I hungry? And then you have to actively say to yourself no, and you're like, oh, this action probably doesn't align here.
Yeah, sure. And you know, on the language as well, you know, taking it back to food and, you know, clean eating, good and bad foods, all that sort of stuff, that plays in as well, doesn't it? How people describe their particular, you know, chosen way to eat.
Yeah, because it's dichotomous thinking, and dichotomous thinking in general is associated with poorer mental health and poorer, lower mood. But when we look at specifically in regards to nutrition, it's associated with disordered eating. It's associated with increased risk of binge eating, because you fall into the guilt and the shame cycle whenever you eat something that's not quote unquote good. and you're much more likely to overeat on something if you feel shame and you feel guilt because you're not compassionate with yourself. You don't say, that's okay, everyone eats a pizza sometimes, you're human, let's just move on. You say, you're an asshole, how could you have eaten that, what a crap person you are, you may as well just sack off all of your health goals because you're not worthy of doing these things, go and have a tub of ice cream as well and maybe some donuts. And so it's easy to say don't call this a bad food, but like you said, clean eating, healthy foods, even healthy, I tend not to use that. I use the term healthful because I like to think of it in terms of this food is full of micronutrients, for example. So it's health, it's full of health, as opposed to this is healthy and therefore that food is unhealthy. Because even pizza, you know, a healthy diet includes pizza sometimes if you like pizza. So that food is not inherently bad. And no food is inherently bad for you in general anyway. So language is so important, and it's easy for me to catch out clients with it. But I think it's sometimes with ourselves, we have to be really on it and notice when we're having these conversations with ourselves and say, oh, I shouldn't have that. Shouldn't have those in the house. Why shouldn't you have those in the house? Who told you you shouldn't? Like, we develop so many rules like that for ourselves, and we need to kind of hold ourselves accountable to that.
Yeah, definitely. And we're, as humans, we're really susceptible about it, isn't it? So when someone, you know, comes out and says, it's like even now still people like will demonize, you know, bread. And I was like, I think that was the 80s when that all thing happened. But it's still a thing, right? You go, oh, I really need to lose weight. I'm going to stop eating bread. Yeah. But, it, you know, we really are susceptible to these. And I think social media as well, because you have to, if you've got a minute on Instagram, people put things in sound bites. So even unintentionally, they might, you know, there's no context, is there, you know, so it's easy to get lost. You mentioned micronutrients there as well, so, you know, vitamins and minerals. What with the focus on micronutrients, is it just a case of like trying to eat the rainbow, or are this specific, like how specific do you go when you're programming for someone?
I encourage variety for everyone, and that's generally the healthiest way to go in terms of making sure you get sufficient micronutrients, is trying to get sufficient variety. And for optimal, say for example, for optimal gut health, we want 30 different plant-based foods a week, which seems like a lot, but that includes things like vegetables, fruits, grains, seeds, nuts, etc. So it's not as high as you think, but I work off the premise of the more variety, the better, and that's generally fine. And unless you've got you're following a specific diet, like if you're vegan, for example, you're at an increased risk of certain deficiencies like iron or B12. And so you may need to then pay more attention to that and potentially supplement with those things. But if you have an inclusive diet, then that's generally where I fall in terms of the only deficiencies I generally will be mindful of are omega-3 if you're not eating oily fish, vitamin D because you get 95% of that from sunlight, so it's not even a nutritional thing, and then like I said, if someone doesn't eat certain foods, then you want to be a bit more mindful of it. But in general, most things should be covered if you've got a varied diet.
Right, sure. Yeah, and you mentioned before as well about like certain foods, how they affect us hormonally, you know, dopamine and stuff like that. And I'm gonna be really careful how I phrase this, because I'm not asking you to like diagnose a specific food, but if someone is struggling maybe with like low mood or something like that, can we look at diet? Can we, you know, maybe increase one thing to see how that affects the balance internally?
Yeah, do you know what? I think people often look at food as a medicine, so to speak, for these types of things. And in general, you know, there's not a specific food that's going to change your mood. If we again look at the research, if someone was to say to me what's the most healthiest way to eat, I would say the Mediterranean diet. And this, the research is not quite there yet, but in terms of there was a study, and this is one study, and I don't know enough about the full research behind this, but there was one study that looked at the Mediterranean diet in depression and found some positive associations of a Mediterranean style diet in terms of mood and depression scores. And so if I really got pushed into it, I would say like let's look at a Mediterranean style diet, so increasing your essential fatty acid, your fatty acids, your whole grain intake, your vegetable fiber intake, but again, they're quite classical kind of quote-unquote healthy diet attributes.
Yeah, sure. And I suppose there's so much, like, you know, yes, the Mediterranean diet is probably, you know, vastly improves your mood if you also live next to the Mediterranean, right?
Yeah, like, yeah.
There's a few other factors that are going
yeah.
on. Going
and you're on eating that well. Meal in the sunshine at 8 o'clock at night with your family. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and you've just had a siesta in the middle of the day or whatever, you know. So, super. So yeah, where can if people want to find out a bit more about you, Amelia, where can they connect with you? Where can they find you?
My Instagram is probably the best place, Amelia Thompson PhD. My website is Amelia.fitness and the nutrition course that I run is eiqnutrition.com.
Oh, fantastic. Oh, that's good, mate. Well, thank you so much. So much for joining me today. I'm a huge fan of your social media. I've followed you for quite a while and it really, you have a really good way of like making people think about stuff. You know, I read something and go, oh yeah, I've never really thought about it like that. And it okay. takes a bit of digesting for want of that's a pretty bad pun really. But, but yeah, thank you very much for joining me today. I really, really appreciate your time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening from the Proper Mental Podcast. Please like and subscribe.
Plus 5 stars.